In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 400. We are at episode 400. It's unbelievable. Thank you so much for listening, for spreading the word, for linking to the episodes on your social media, doing what you can to get the word out, because I really do appreciate it, and we have made it this far, 400 episodes on so many different topics. You can look at all of them at tomwoods.com/episodes, or better yet, subscribe to the show on iTunes or Stitcher using the links you'll find at tomwoods.com. Well, today we're going to talk about Ayn Rand. Now, according to Salon, if you have a libertarian podcast, that's all you talk about is Ayn Rand. But we haven't devoted an episode to Ayn Rand, and I thought I would do that today. And joining me to talk about Ayn Rand is our old friend Michael Malice once again. Michael Malice is a celebrity ghostwriter. He is the author of Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. Very interesting and enjoyable book to read, I might add. You'll see him frequently on Kennedy on the Fox Business Network, and I'm very glad to welcome him back right now. Michael Malice, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
Seems like we had you just 7 episodes ago, because as a matter of fact, that's how many episodes ago we did have you the last time. But I want to talk to you again because I have a topic that I think you are very well suited to help us address, and it's a topic that I have not addressed yet, and here we are in episode number 400. How can this be that we have not talked about objectivism or Ayn Rand at all, really, except fleetingly? So here's an episode on that subject. For all you folks who have been demanding one, here it is. I have not planned out how this is going to go, because I feel like it's almost a contradiction in terms to have a planned out Michael Malice episode, right? You can have one or the other. So I thought we would just start talking and see where the conversation goes. It will be just like, I use this example sometimes, the Beatles TV movie Magical Mystery Tour. The idea was they were going to drive a bus around England and record whatever happened. But it turns out basically nothing did happen, and it was a huge flop. I don't think that's going to happen in this episode. Do you want to start? I mean, I can't imagine there are that many people who don't know Ayn Rand or what we're talking about, but do you want to give us at least a little bit of background, the basic history of, I mean, of where she grew up and how she came to the U.S. and stuff like that to get us started?
Well, actually, I would strongly disagree with you. I think there's a lot of people in the liberty movement who don't really know Rand. They know her reputation as this crazy lady. They know her by some of the more out there statements that she's made, and they're comfortable dismissing her. And I think it's really does her a disservice and the liberty movement a disservice, because up until Rand Paul, there's been no one, this is pretty objective, who's brought people around to a pro-liberty perspective than Ayn Rand. Don't you think that's fair to say?
I don't know. I mean, I would assume it's true because of the sales of her novels, and that much as I might wish it were different, the sales of Mises' books, can't match that. Mises and others acknowledge that we need to reach out through the popular culture, through novels and movies and these other ways to reach people, because people aren't going to buy Human Action. They're just not. Not everybody's going to do that. So it could well be that by the sheer size of her audience that she can make that claim. Maybe Milton Friedman is a close second.
Oh, God. Well, I mean, if you want to consider, right, okay.
We'll have a Milton Friedman episode, right? That'll be That'll be episode 701, because I've already pledged you're not getting another even 100. Like, this is it, okay? Enjoy episode 400, Malice. All right.
We could talk about Milton Friedman when there's literally nothing left to discuss.
All right. Listen, but I do still want you to give people the basic, her basic history, like, sure, in a nutshell, and then we'll talk about her ideas.
So sure. So she's born in this in Russia in 1905. She grows up there completely despising, by her own words, everything and anything about it, including the Tsarist period. Come 1926, she gets to escape, leaving her family behind, and makes her way to the America, barely speaking the language, to try to become a screenwriter. She happens upon Cecil B. DeMille. In a fortuitous circumstance, he cast her as an extra in The King of Kings, where she also happens to meet her future husband, Frank O'Connor. They kind of fall in love, and they cross the border into Mexico and return, so that way she can get her citizenship. Her screenwriting career doesn't really go anywhere, but she writes a couple of novels, Anthem and We the Living, which was semi-autobiographical, and a book about living in Stalinism and Leninism. And her big breakthrough hit, of course, was The Fountainhead, which is a novel about morality and integrity. And then her magnum opus is Atlas Shrugged, which, you know, it's just a huge brick and it's just probably the Bible of libertarianism for many people, other than the actual Bible. And after that, you know, she had this protege, Nathaniel Brandon, and he started something called NBI. And she developed her thought into this philosophy that she called objectivism, which is very controversial, very intense and complex. But again, so she was a very much an interesting character. She very much did not – she explicitly said, I'm not a libertarian, because she thought libertarianism meant Murray Rothbard, and she called anarchists hippies of the right. My hair is not that long, and I know yours is not either, so to call us hippies is kind of odd. After she died in 82, you know, her estate became something called, in I think 86 they were founded, the Ayn Rand Institute, and they really are this somewhat cult-like acolytes of her worldview, which has kind of faded a little bit with Yaron Brook taking over ARI from Rand's heir, Leonard Peikoff.
All right, that's a pretty good overview. I would add that when one of the times you were on, might have been the very first time, we did briefly talk about Rand, as I'm recalling now, because I remember I pointed out that I'm a bit of an oddball in terms of her novels, because I think I maybe prefer her book We the Living, which gets overlooked.
Yes.
Everybody knows the two giant books, and then she has Anthem. People know because it's so short they can breeze through it. And then We the Living from the 1930s, maybe 1936.
Correct.
Gets overlooked, but that the setting of that is communist Russia, and it makes for a very, very interesting and compelling story. Many memorable lines in that book as well.
Yeah, and We the Living was the inspiration, one of the big ones for my book, Dear Reader, because as someone who was born in the Soviet Union, obviously I did not go through Stalinism. By the time, you know, we were leaving in the late 70s, it was far removed from that era. But when you read that book and the pathos that just seeps through from every page, it really is mind-boggling. One thing we talked about earlier in an earlier interview, Tom, was about, you know, not using, you know, hatred and anger as tools for libertarianism. You read that book, We the Living, and you do get angry, and you do hate the state, and you do realize what it means in practice. And in a sense, many people, and I don't know if I'm 100%. You know, not being tongue-in-cheek when I say this, it's not that I love liberty so much as I'm terrified of what totalitarianism means. And I see how close it is, you know, to slip into that.
All right, let's talk about her ideas, because this is really where things get interesting. Of course, what also gets interesting is how the ideas get, well, passed on, but also the people who do the passing on and the people who spread objectivism after Ayn Rand, because that opens up all kinds of stories about personalities and institutional rivalries and purges and stuff like that. I'd like to, at least for the time being, though, stick to Rand herself and her ideas. So tell me then, of course, she's got a full-fledged philosophy. She's got views on epistemology, she's got views on aesthetics, but give me the ideas that, let's say, the average person reasonably acquainted with her is going to walk away with.
Well, Rand was once asked in an interview to if she can define her philosophy while standing on one foot, and she literally did so, and it was as follows. Metaphysics, objective reality, meaning what is real is what is in front of us. There's one reality and that's it. Epistemology, how do we know things, is through reason. Morality is what she called selfishness, but what she meant is self-interest. And politics is laissez-faire capitalism. Now, something that she talks about, which I don't think has been analyzed in terms of her work, and she's been analyzed to death, of course, you know, both pro and con. You know, she mentions that when she was, I don't remember what it was, either 8 or 10, you know, she had her entire philosophy deduced in her head. And now she explicitly said, obviously, I did not know as much as I knew later in life, but I never had to change any of my essentials. Now, this says to me either one of two things. One, it's true, in which case she's not going to have a good understanding of how to get people to change that philosophy they have since they're a young age, or it's kind of false and she's really not being very receptive to outside feedback. So it's a very curious claim she makes that I don't think many people pick up on. And it also speaks to something else we spoke about earlier, Tom, in an earlier appearance, is that how much of our worldview is really formed in kind of these non-rational terms. Like we see something is wrong on some level, and then we ask ourselves, why am I having an aversion to this incident? Like if you see a cop yelling at someone, you know, and throwing his weight around, the reaction is immediate. This is something that upsets me. And then later we can sit down and deduce, you know, why this is an issue.
All right. I think the average person who knows about Rand will know nothing about her views on metaphysics. The average person is getting his views about her either by casually reading Atlas Shrugged, although I don't know how you can casually read a 1,000-plus-page book, or from what he reads in the media.
Yeah.
And so he walks away saying, Rand thinks you should be selfish and that everybody should aspire to be some kind of ubermensch who can, you know, who creates and then just keeps all the fruits for himself. And I mean, that's it. That really, that's what people think when they hear her name. That's certainly what anybody on Slate thinks, or Salon, or Alternet. That's what her name means to them. But at the same time, it's not like there isn't a grain of truth in that. But what is the truth in that?
Well, I mean, she was asked this when she was on a Donahue appearance, and she was on Donahue twice, and you can see them on YouTube. They're absolutely hilarious and fascinating, especially when she gets asked by some housewife if it's true that she's a member of the Illuminati. This actually happened. What was your question again? I'm sorry, Tom. I lost my train of thought.
Well, is there a grain of truth
right
in the caricature?
So Donahue asked her about this, and he goes, a lot of people out there think you're nuts. And she said, no, they want you to think it. So Rand is very dangerous for people and very useful for people who like liberty for the following reasons. She advocates strongly in a logical, conscious approach to how you act. She does not give people the leeway to have their principles in their mind and act differently in practice. And her call to integrity is really the entire message of The Fountainhead. It's not a political book really in any sense. And this is something that I think more people should be useful for, should think about, because if you look at Facebook, there are many people who act, you know, in a sense of salvation through faith. As long as I have the right views and I click on the right petitions and I post the right updates, therefore I'm a good person. And Rand says, no, you have to act as a rational actor, put your ideas in practice, do what you know to be right, and you know, life is a blessing, and live it to its fullest. And this is a scary message for many people, because then they are forced to, you know, kind of think about what they're doing and have to defend every action, where usually their defense is, I'm just doing what everyone else is doing. And that's the, you know, the popular mode of the moment. And she's violently against this kind of thinking.
I recall a letter in her copious letters. I read there was a huge volume that came out in the 1990s, Letters of Ayn Rand. And I took it out of the library and found it extremely interesting. But I recall a letter she wrote, might have been to a niece of hers, who had asked her for the
yes,
princely sum of $25.
Yes.
And should have known her aunt better, right? I mean, who is this kid? You don't know that your aunt is Ayn Rand, for heaven's sake? So Rand writes her this ideological response,
yeah,
about, if I do this, you're going to turn out to be a parasite the rest of your life. And so
No, that's not exactly accurate.
Okay, well, I mean, look, it's 20 years since I read it.
Well, no, the letter, which someone just recently posted in one of those websites as an article, like listen to this Ayn Rand article, the point she made is, I lent your sister money and your older sister, and she never paid me back.
Okay, that's reasonable.
And it's not fair to judge you by that standard. However, it is fair to judge you as an adult. And if I'm lending you this, I expect to be repaid. And you can prove to me that you're different from your sister by putting your money where your mouth is. So she very much had this odd – she didn't really know how to deal with kids. And kids are really not an issue in any of her books. So she just really in many ways thought children are kind of miniaturized adults and spoke to them as such. And frankly, you know, she's very much reaching, you know, precocious – teenagers and young adults with her books, and I think people like that would respond to being spoken to with respect and treated as, you know, full adults, even if they really aren't.
Well, and the funny thing is, as I've gotten older, I've actually moved more toward her views in that letter. As I observe the world and I observe the way people are,
yeah,
I've actually grown more sympathetic to the letter, now, especially now that I am a parent and I am responsible for children. Speaking of children, let's just be blunt and honest with each other here in this whole thing.
Okay.
It seems like it can't just be a coincidence that a whole lot of the objectivists, that is the followers of Ayn Rand that I know, have no children. Why is that?
Well, I think it's also no coincidence that they have no sense of humor.
That's also true.
Yeah. And these are both so she is a tricky figure, and they accuse her of being a cult figure, and that's somewhat true and somewhat isn't. But if you are such a radical and you kind of conflate your personal life and you hold yourself up as an example to live by, and she did this explicitly when she was asked during the NBI days.
Tell people what NBI is.
That institute that her protege Nathaniel Brandon made when she was promulgating her philosophy. When she was asked, you know, these characters you write about, they're not realistic. They don't comport to reality. She says, don't tell me such people don't exist. You're looking at two of them, referring to herself and Nathaniel Brandon. And then she said, here are two more, referring to their spouses. So she very much held herself up as, you know, someone to mimic and follow. And when you are not as bright as her, which I don't think anyone who follows her is going to be as bright as her, almost in a sense by definition, it's very, very hard psychologically, and this isn't really a flaw, but it's very hard psychologically to separate the wheat from the chaff. So if you're going to follow someone who's right 90% of the time, 10% of the time you're going to go down the wrong path. And her lack of humor, because she thought humor in its nature has to be derisive. Even though she used irony in her books and there's many humorous moments, she was not a funny person and didn't realize what a weapon that could be, because she really had a reverence for humanity. She had a reverence for reason and for liberty and man's achievement. So to even be joking about that in her mind, it seems like is denigrating it and giving in kind of to the masses who are trying to, you know, give everyone feet of clay.
Can you try to explain what, not on a personal level, but on a philosophical level, was the problem between objectivism and libertarianism? Is it that libertarians don't have an adequate grounding for their belief in freedom?
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Yeah, she had this absolutely, I think, completely false insistence that if you are going to promulgate a political philosophy without a moral grounding, it's doomed to fail. And one of the things she said was, you know, 1964, she was a very big advocate of Barry Goldwater, and she believed until the day she died that if he had a more philosophical defense of capitalism, he would have won. Now, I don't ever imagine any politician giving philosophical speeches and doing anything but turning people away. When you start getting cerebral, the audience just revolts against it, you know, instinctively, and it's really a problem. And she really thought this is the way to bring people to capitalism, and you have to be capitalist for the right reasons. Otherwise, it's not going to stick. And what I think, you know, she has this insistence on the blank slate, that unless we derive our ideas from reason and ground them in reality, they're not going to be, you know, binding on us psychologically or morally in some sense. And sometimes that's true, but sometimes it's really not true. And this is something that her you know, philosopher, her followers insist on, the idea that, you know, Rothbard was to her what libertarianism meant. And she used this example of, you know, he had this idea of competing defense agencies, which she said, oh, you mean like civil war? And let's suppose there's a robber robbing someone's house, and the robber has one defense agency, and I have another as the homeowner. What happens there? You tell me, she said, you know, this kind of apparently rhetorical question, which is easily answered even in a statist society. If a Canadian breaks into an American's house, you know, there's a very simple process figuring out what to do. So she was very uncomfortable with giving other people credit, other than, you know, people like Mises she loved, and a few others. She hated Hayek, describing him as in private as pure poison. But she really, and this is another one of her problems, she really presented everything as a package deal, right? And she had these, you know, extreme views on sexuality, and basically, you know, the claim is Atlas Shrugged integrates sex and economics and art. And I don't think it's true that if someone, you know, is for laissez-faire capitalism, that they're rationally obligated to advocate BDSM in the bedroom. But that's her implication.
Yeah, there are some strange things that are insisted on here, of course. Now, there are some better known things that are insisted on, for example, atheism. And this, of course, seems to be the other side of the coin of reason, that if you believe in reason, then you can't, because she contrasts reason with mysticism, which she assumes that all religious people are simply mystics who have some kind of irrational feeling, or they have an inferiority complex, and that makes them go look for some kind of father figure in the sky or whatever.
She's not as violently atheist as some of her followers, because she said she has some respect for religion, and she says this very condescendingly, because it's in what she called a canned form of philosophy. She thought it was like a primitive but basic attempt to make understanding of the universe. So she wasn't as 1,000% dismissive of religion as you think, but again, that's 99%, you know?
Right, right. Well, of course, today's show notes page will be tomwoods.com/400. Very easy to remember. /400. We'll link to, first of all, the Rand on Donahue videos that you mentioned. We'll put those there because those are worth watching. You'll enjoy those. I'm going to link to related episodes. I mean, one of them will be my episode on Am I a Dummy for Believing in God? Some people love that. Some people wanted to kill me for that. That's what makes the show fun, right? I'll try and put our earlier episode on there also when we talked about this kind of stuff. So she did insist on that. Now, Rothbard insists that she insisted on that quite, well, insistently among the people in her close circle, to the point where it became difficult for him to continue with her because he was married to a Christian woman. Can you tell us, is there anything that we can know about the Rothbard and Rand relationship apart from Rothbard's recollections and his one-act play, Mozart Was a Red?
Well, I mean, we know a fair amount of it. And I spoke to Yuri Maltsev at Porkfest, and he says, and I'm sure he's 100% telling the truth, that till the day he died, Murray Rothbard was a strong advocate of Atlas Shrugged. And Rothbard's problems with Rand were on a personal level, but at no point was he ever anything but, you know, a huge admirer of her work. He was just not an admirer of her social circle, and, you know, with good reason. There, you know, she's kind of holding court in her house, and everyone there is genuflecting. And by the end of her life, she, you know, ended up living alone, not having very many friends at all, and that's not necessarily how it has to be. But if you read The Fountainhead, this is one of the dangers of Rand. She really puts forth the message that, you know, when you're young and you're precocious and you're smarter than everyone, you realize that the teacher at the front of the room really doesn't know what they're doing. It's okay, in this kind of catcher in the rye sense, it's okay to feel isolated and alone and trapped in your own thoughts. And it takes a long time to learn that that's not okay, and it's not a weakness to kind of, you know, share your emotions with people, and that you get bonds through that, and it's not a form of collectivism. And of course, Rand was never saying, you know, don't have any friends, but if you read Fountainhead, there is this underlying message that being kind of completely isolated is an aspect of heroism, and I think it's a very dangerous psychological message to put forward.
All right. Well, that's interesting. I think we should, I mean, I can continue that line, but what I want to make sure we get to is what each of our own pros and cons are when viewing Rand. Like, what do we think is good to take away? What do we think is bad to take away? Like, what have you taken away from Rand that you say is, if not indispensably helpful, then pretty darn helpful?
I'd say indispensably a couple of things. First of all, I would say Rand does not have all the answers, but she has all the questions. If you read, you know, her books, and you have to read them in order, make sure you read Fountainhead before Atlas Shrugged, you are going to have to face logically and rationally all the big issues that, you know, address you morally and politically. And that is a huge, huge deal that she brings to the table. The other thing that I think she's wonderful about is people are not always persuaded rationally. They're persuaded through art. They're persuaded through vision. You know, Rand had a vision for what a free society would look like. And to put that forward in her novels is something completely incomparable, you know, to advocating for praxeology and human action. It's very hard to say what would this look like in practice, and she does that. So I think these two things cannot be taken away from her. She's really the ferryman who brings people across the River Styx and makes them realize, you know what? Almost everything you're being told in the press and in school is not only a lie, and it's a lie for the following reasons. And when you start deconstructing everything you've been taught since you were a kid, it's really this kind of intoxicating perspective on the world.
All right, let me say something myself. First of all, her nonfiction essays I generally enjoy very much because I like her punchy rhetorical style. She writes in a way that makes you not quite feel sorry for her opponents because she makes you utterly contemptuous of them.
Yes.
But if they were anyone other than those people, you would feel sorry for them. And you say to yourself, I'm glad she never knew me and got angry at me because I would not want to be on the receiving end of this. I love reading a great, informed, and skilled polemicist. And she was definitely that above other things. Secondly, I know that I feel like one of the alleged drawbacks of her novels is at the same time a virtue. Her characters, it's true, at times do seem a bit wooden, yeah, and they're delivering soliloquies and so forth. But those soliloquies, of course, are often very beautiful. Like there's a soliloquy about the meaning of money, what money really means. There's nothing evil about it in Atlas Shrugged. And as if I'm remembering this right, she took some of the best of these speeches from her characters and then published a book of those. Remembering that right? Is that For a New Intellectual?
That was her first nonfiction book called For the New Intellectual. And there was an introductory essay with the same title in that book, which is basically her overview of world history. And it's, this is one of the criticisms of Rand. She'll do things in that overview, like she'll dismiss Egyptian culture, ancient Egyptian culture in one sentence, like, oh, it hasn't changed in thousands of years. And it's like, you know, these people created the tallest building on Earth until like 1840, so they're not complete idiots. So you have to take a lot of what she says in there with a grain of salt.
Now let me talk about some of the drawbacks. I mean, obviously there's something wrong here, given the problems with some of her followers. I'm going to get complaints from people, and I understand. I don't mean to say everybody who is interested in or follows Ayn Rand is a humorless automaton who doesn't want to have children. I don't want to say that, but I do know that the people who are the most committed to it, I have personally found this. I invited somebody onto this show who wrote a book on, I better not say the subject because then it'll be obvious who it is, and a book of great interest to my listeners, and he even sent me a copy of the book as a review copy back when I was at the Mises Institute. So I thought, hey, you know what? I should have this guy on. So I wrote to him, and we got this friendly letter back. He's at one of the major Randian institutes. And he wrote back, and very polite, but he said he was not able to do this at this time. And my producer and I drew exactly the same conclusion. The decision has been handed down, yeah, that you can't go on my show. Yeah. So there's clearly something. And then, of course, we all have infighting, but the purges and the I am breaking with so-and-so, I mean, they're so dramatic. Like, the world cares about what's going on at Randian Institute. In fact, a former guest on this show, Brian Kaplan, he went to a Randian or Objectivist summer seminar when he was in college, and he said there was a purge going on during the seminar. So we would wake up and there would be people no longer there that day who had been there the previous day. Like, there was something weird going on about that.
That sounds pretty awesome. But no, let me just say.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah. And then I got one more thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Very germane, which you just made me think of. They're very, very bad at being persuasive. And here's an example. During the tsunami that hit Southeast Asia, within the last decade, I don't remember exactly when, you know, the Ayn Rand Institute took out a full-page ad denouncing charity as a moral, you know, obligation. And is there any worse time and a place when people are dying and homeless due to a natural disaster? Is this really when people are going to be receptive to your message of selfishness? You know, this is really the time when you say, let's throw philosophy in a kind of this cerebral sense out the window. Let's get the people fed, and then we can discuss, you know, the implications and so on and so forth. So it's very, very tin-eared.
The other thing I would say is that, for example, in Atlas Shrugged, although there are important themes in it and that are certainly quite valid, on the other hand, and I realized this, I think, only when I saw the movie versions, for which, of course, she bears no responsibility or blame, I could not believe how badly done they are, especially considering how many starving actors there are out there who are talented. Like, why did they find people who were so bad? I mean, yeah. But on the other hand, you realize they do have to say wooden things. But right. I know some actors who could say those wooden things better than these people did. But the point is, I realize that there is something cartoonish about Atlas Shrugged. Not in the way a progressive would. They would think it's cartoonish because it appreciates entrepreneurs and stuff. But the way she describes what happens in an interventionist society is clearly not the way it happens. There is no law for the equalization of incomes. Could you imagine the richest people in America allowing that to happen? I mean, the implication of Atlas Shrugged would be that a democratic society really is a democratic society, and my vote is just as important as David Rockefeller's vote. But that's not the case. There's no way David Rockefeller is going to allow a law for the equalization of incomes. It's going to be much more subtle than that.
Yeah, and she, you know, she was for Nixon being, you know, and against Reagan. So she very much believed in the democratic process, and I think she had a very poor understanding of how it actually works in practice and how rigged it is and pointless it is, if not downright pernicious.
All right, let's wrap things up with, let's say, two recommendations from you. The fiction recommendation you would say people ought to jump into first if they're interested, and the nonfiction one.
Well, I would just say, first of all, I think anyone who's interested in liberty has to read Rand, if only to know what they're talking about when people start attacking her. And they're just novels, you know, so I would say definitely start with Anthem. It's 100 pages. You'll get it whether you like it or not. That's fair. As for nonfiction, I would say there's no point in reading her nonfiction until you've read her fiction, because I think her fiction is so much more moving and entertaining that you can get a lot of the stuff from her nonfiction, you know, either elsewhere or after you've gone through The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged.
Now, I myself am, again, a little different from you on this. I didn't enjoy Anthem at all. And if I had started with Anthem, I think I would have ended with Anthem. So I'll recommend We the Living as one to get started, because you don't have to make the investment of time that you would with Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. But I bet you'll want to look at those after you read We the Living. And then secondly, I enjoyed reading Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. It has essays by other people as well, but they're really strong essays that still hold up after many decades. All right. Do you have any final parting words? I don't want you to feel like you didn't get your full say.
Oh, no. I mean, there's just so much to talk about with Rand, and I just think it's very easy to criticize her, and she opened herself up for that by being so antagonistic, which is to her credit. But I think people really need to recognize, you know, what an asset she was to the movement, and to really understand what it is that she's trying to say.
Well, everybody, make sure not only to check out the show notes page for today, tomwoods.com/400. We'll have helpful links to some of the books we've been talking about. Also, links to Michael Malice. You should visit him at michaelmalice.com, where you can find out still more ways to visit him through social media. And, of course, get his book, Dear Reader. Right? Just give us the 30-second plug for Dear Reader before you get out of here.
It's the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. If you're interested in North Korea and don't want to blow your brains out while reading a book about how depressing it is, I made it entertaining and I made it coherent.
It's a wonderful book. It's a fantastic idea. I'm so glad you did it, and I'm so glad you joined me today for episode 400. So the next time you're on, it's going to be like, you know, 463, like some obscure number. Anyway, thanks for doing it. I appreciate it. It was great.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody, do please allow me to say a few words of thanks on this occasion of the 400th episode of The Tom Woods Show. First of all, thank you for listening. If nobody were listening, I wouldn't be doing this, but I got a bunch of you folks listening, and I sure appreciate that, and I get so many notes from people saying, I listen to you every single day. Wow. That is great. Thank you very much, because I do release a new episode every single weekday. So do make sure and subscribe at tomwoods.com. Of course, it's a free show. All you have to do is listen. But some of you have gone above and beyond. I've got people who are helping me out by using the Amazon widget that you find on all the show notes pages. For example, this one, tomwoods.com/400. And at no extra cost to yourself, when you make your Amazon purchases, you help out the show. And thanks to that, I'm able to have a producer. I'm able to have an office for the show. And I don't have to be out of pocket. And I really do appreciate that. I have 5 kids. There are a lot of expenses. So you guys are helping to make the show possible when you do that. And I'm really, really grateful to you for that. And of course, a very, very special word of thanks to all of you who have made the decision to support the show as supporting listeners, which you can do at supportinglisteners.com. I hope you feel like you're getting a fair exchange for what you're supporting the show with. I'm trying to give as much stuff as I can, not just transcripts of all the interviews, which is a nice bonus as well, and not just coupons for all kinds of Liberty stuff that you guys like to use, but also my courses for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, discounts or free subscriptions to Liberty Classroom, lifetime subscriptions, all kinds of stuff, autographed books. I'm trying to make it a fair exchange. So if you feel like the show is giving you value, do please check that out at supportinglisteners.com. Tomorrow, it's episode number 401. It's not too early to start thinking, what should we do for episode 500? Something special. What should we do for episode 500? I will happily accept suggestions for episode 500. But that's another time. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.